right, the Health and Human Service Committee will come to order. We are just short of a quorum for the moment, but we will get started here. House File 952 is going to be the first bill, Representative Keel. And when we do get quorum, Representative Keel will move that this be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. So, Representative Keel, we have the bill in front of us as well as we can, if you'd like to present on your bill.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. Yes, I would appreciate that. House File 952 is requiring hearing training for medical staff that work with people that are hard of hearing. We can't move that either, can we?
Actually, Representative, we do have quorum now, so I'll officially call the meeting to order, and we'll have you move that House File 952 be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance.
Okay.
And now you have the DE-4-2
correct.
That you'd like to move?
Correct.
Representative Keel moves the DE-4-2 in order to get the bill into the form that she wishes to present it. Are there any questions? Seeing none, all those in favor of the DE-4-2 signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Representative Keel, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What this would do, the change in this, is that it would ask that there is training given to all those who work with hard of hearing, and actually nurses in general or medical staff in general, so that they understand the needs of someone who is hard of hearing. Often I find that I have some family members that are hard of hearing, and I often find, ironically, that they talk in the ear with no hearing aid in, assuming that's the good ear, when in fact my mother's good ear is the one with the hearing aid. And I think it's kind of odd because she's been hard of hearing for 20 years. So it's not like we, her children, don't know which ear to talk to. But and make sure we catch her. And actually, the other things that I've watched happen are walking into traffic, not knowing which direction the sound is coming from. But more importantly, when we work with seniors, especially in a nursing home setting, if they can't hear what's happening to them, they often will strike out, not knowing what to expect. And it was really important that staff does understand how that affects a patient or a client, someone they're taking care of. And I would hope that this training would really help our nursing staff. We took away the mandatory requirement of 2 hours. And I've talked to some other groups, and I'm hoping that they will really be able to push this in training of different sorts eventually, so that nurses can actually, staff can actually get this online also, to understand how important it is that people know what you're doing. You know, even if you're maybe the cleaning lady that's coming in to clean a patient's room, that she knows to make it clear that that's what she's in the room doing, so that especially I find for people with dementia and Alzheimer's, they need to know, even if they don't remember 2 minutes later, they need to be addressed. So with that, I have a testifier that we're trying to see if we can get a video going, but in the meantime, we have a testifier here that would like to speak to us.
All right, welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
My name is Dr. Kathleen Marin, M-A-R-I-N. I'm a psychologist with hearing loss, and I'm also here primarily because my mother has been in assisted living, memory care, and currently in a nursing home recovering from a fall. So I've had a lot of experience with the staff, with the procedures in assisted living and long-term care facilities. And the first thing I want to say is I am so grateful that we can entrust the care of our vulnerable loved ones to such dedicated and capable and caring staff. But one area that they are lacking is training in hearing loss. People with hearing loss have special communication needs. We need to get their attention before saying something to them. Otherwise, they miss the beginning of the sentence. We need to face them directly so that they can see us and do some lip reading or speech reading, as it's now called. We need to speak clearly. We need to speak in a slightly louder tone of voice, but not shouting. We need to decrease the background noise so that they can actually hear us. These are common sense things, but most of us don't think about them until we actually are faced with our own hearing loss and have to figure out what works for us. Without this kind of thing, and this would also include written material, captioning, assistive listening devices, all this kind of training, but without this, the residents often miss out on a lot of things. Like, for instance, what are their meal choices for the day? What are the activities? Can they participate in the activities? What are their treatment plans? They need to know this kind of stuff. They also miss out on a whole other level: friendship, laughter, fun, warmth. When this happens, it's likely to lead to isolation, and the isolation is often likely to lead to depression, and it also does tend to bring about some dementia or can enhance it. The other thing is, this kind of isolation and hearing loss can be confused with depression or dementia, and so the person can be treated inappropriately. I want to tell you about a friend of mine, Betty, who's living in an assisted living. She loved books. She loved people. She was warm, vibrant, kind. She had a significant hearing loss, and we talked at length about that, because so do I, and she talked about how lonely she was. Whenever I visited her, she was almost always in the common area, but alone. She was sitting there with her book. Life swirled around Betty, but Betty couldn't participate in it. However, one-on-one, she lit up. She just needed people, especially the staff, to come and talk to her one-on-one using these communication techniques. The assisted living where she was staying announced everything on PAs, and all of the rooms had a speaker. So all the meal times were announced, the activities were announced. So Betty frequently missed meals or showed up late, and so on. After a while, Betty just started to fade away. And I watched this, and it was tremendously sad. And she just stopped participating. She became more isolated. And the majority of this, in my opinion, was due to the fact that she could not interact with staff and residents because they just didn't know how to interact with her. I don't think this needed to happen. And I also want you to know that Betty is not alone. One out of every three people age 65 and older has a hearing loss. One out of every two age 75 and older has a hearing loss. This means that a large portion of the people in long-term care facilities are struggling with hearing loss and would really benefit from appropriate communication skills, assisted listening devices, written materials, captioning, anything we can do to help them. Also, a lot of them don't even know they have a hearing loss, and so we need to have our staff, that would be nurses, aides, physical and occupational therapists, recognize the signs of hearing loss so they can perhaps help this person get a hearing evaluation. I just think it's so important to train the really wonderful, capable staff in this new area for them so that our loved ones can have the best life possible in their later years. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Marin, for your testimony this morning. Questions for the testifier, Representative Sandstead.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair. This actually might be a question for the author. Mm-hmm. On the DE amendments 1.22, it says, in addition to the topics listed in paragraph in paragraph A, orientation may also contain. So I guess I'm wondering, is this bill making it optional training or required training?
Representative Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Sandstead. It is making it optional. Trying to encourage medical facilities there's a lot of requirements already, and we have asked that they make it an emphasis and make sure that staff is trained to deal with.
Representative Sandstead.
Thank you. then following that paragraph, it goes on to state that some of the things must be implemented or must be introduced. So if it's not required, how do you implement those other pieces?
Representative Keel.
Yes, Madam Chair.
All right.
Can I have
the assistance this morning? Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Beth Fraser with the Commission of Deaf, Deafblind, and Hard of Hearing Minnesotans. So this training is optional, and the bill clarifies that it counts towards orientation or toward the annual training requirements. And in paragraph B that starts on 2.29, as well as above, I believe, it says it may contain this training, and says any training on hearing loss must include the following information. So if it's going to count toward those requirements, it has to be high-quality training on certain topics. But the training is optional as to whether or not they provide it.
Thank you.
Representative, okay, Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and this is to the author. Representative Keela, a moment ago you said this was applied to medical facilities, and I just want to be clear. I was understanding that this was for assisted living only. Am I correct in that, or is it a little broader than that?
Representative Keela.
A little broader than that, right?
It is. It does include home care, and some of that training is already done in nursing homes when I think about it. It's what they do.
Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. But Representative Kim, my question is really to the bill. Who does the bill actually apply to?
Home care.
You.
Excuse me. Home care.
Okay. So, thank you, Mr. Chair. So, it doesn't apply to assisted living then, Representative Kim?
Representative Kim.
Good question.
Home and community-based would also be assisted living.
Oh, okay.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Just wanted to really understand that. And, you know, I think this is a really important topic. I think it's very much probably overlooked among all of us. You know, the more I've learned about hearing loss, the more I've understood what an impactful condition it is for a person's whole being. So I'm glad to see this being taken up. I guess my question then, and Representative Keel, I don't know if you know the answer to this. If you don't, that's fine. But I'm just wondering, when someone moves into one of these facilities, what are they, when they're picking a facility, which I know is a huge challenge for families, how do you, you know, finding the right facility, are people told or will they be told whether the facility does this training? Because I would think, for example, if I had an elderly mother who needed an assisted living facility and she had hearing loss, I would want to find a facility where they're doing this training. Will I have a way, will our constituents have a way to know if the facility they're picking is doing this?
Representative Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Liebling, in my personal experience has been that we talk about what is needed for family. I don't believe it's mandatory that what I'm thinking is it could get missed if family and staff are not on the same page, something maybe we need to check on to make sure that is addressed. However, I guess my experience has been sitting down with staff when you are first interviewing for a residence, what do you provide? Here's my loved one, and this is what they need. These are the issues that they have, and probably when I think about it, more deeply addressed when you actually move in and have those conversations. So it's probably something you wouldn't be shopping for, so to speak, when you move into when you're looking for a residence.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Keel. Well, this is something that your bill kind of brought to mind a comment that I had from a constituent who was in an assisted living facility and was distressed because there were things that were missing that he didn't realize when he chose the facility and was asking me about, disclosures. And I guess probably I'd like someone, I know we have people in the room who can probably answer this question, and maybe they can answer it for me offline. But, you know, what are we actually requiring facilities to disclose to people so there's sort of a standard understanding when people move in? And I know this is has been a changing issue as we've had more and more different kinds of facilities come online. But it is something I think that, you know, it's great if you have, you know, if it's you and you're with your mother, and you can go there with your list of questions and make sure you get everything answered, but not everybody has family that has the wherewithal to do that, or maybe even family at all to help them. And so, and people, of course, are extraordinarily vulnerable when they have those needs, and sometimes on short notice they've got to find a place. And so I think it's an area where some more consumer protection might be really useful and helpful if there isn't some already. So just wanted to put that out there. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Keel.
I would just address it as something maybe we should look into, but also, yes, I've had a lot of experience, unfortunately, and, yeah, the last-minute stuff is very stressful, and you're not thinking, you're just thinking to provide whatever someone needs, as opposed to when you've got a few weeks to decide. But it is something we maybe should look into. And I would suspect that a lot of places do say, here's a list of what we provide, but we'll do some checking, and maybe there's somebody in the audience that can enlighten us eventually.
Thank you.
All right. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify on House File 952? Seeing none, other questions for Representative Keel? Seeing none, Representative Keel.
Mr. Chair, we actually got this two-minute video. Would that be all right if we played it?
As your final word, 2 minutes, go ahead.
Sure.
It'll take 2 minutes to get it up and running. Might be because we're in the basement. We're in 200. I started in the basement. Lights are off. Lights are obviously off in my head.
The anticipation's killing me, Representative.
Yes. Sorry, Mr. Chair. It doesn't look like it's going to come up. So, members, I would ask you to please vote for the bill.
All right, and we do have a question. Representative Franzen.
No, I'll do that after the bill.
After the bill. Okay. With that, Representative Keel renews her motion that House File 952 be, as amended, be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails in House File 952 as amended is referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. Thank you, Representative Keel.
Thank you.
Let's see. Is Chair Dean in? All right. Chair Dean, welcome. We have a couple bills up this morning for you, Chair Dean. Which one would you like to move first?
Mr. Chair, members, I would like to move House File 1314.
All right. Chair Dean moves that House File 1314 be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service. Fine. The General Register. To the General Register. Chair Dean moves that House File 1314 be re-referred to the General Register. We have the bill before us. Hear your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This bill is a very simple bill that takes a step forward from Chair Mack's work last year in telemedicine. And what it does is it just seeks to define the doctor-patient relationship within telemedicine so that you can establish a doctor-patient relationship without being in the same room, laying hands on in a doctor-patient relationship. This says that you can do that. The second piece of this bill in line 1.19 is just says that the standards of practice within telemedicine are no different than any other standard of practice within the subspecialty, so it's no different, so that the standards of care are the same And I do have one oral amendment, if I could, Mr. Chair, to move that.
All right. To your amendment.
The amendment would be that I would move on line 1.13, add a comma after the word audio.
Chair, could you repeat that?
Line 1.13, add a comma after the word audio. The comma provides clarity that telemedicine can take place by audio or visual technologies. It just makes it a little bit clearer.
All right. Chair Dean moves that on line 1.13, there be a comma placed after the word audio. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The oral amendment is adopted. All right. Do you have any testifiers this morning, Representative Dean?
I do not. I do have some folks that can answer questions if necessary. Otherwise, I can respond to questions or just ask for your support.
Okay. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify on House File 1314? Seeing none, are there questions from members on House File 1314? Final word, Chair Dean.
I appreciate your support.
With that, Chair Dean renews this motion that House File 1314, as amended, be re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails, and House File 1314, as amended, is re-referred to the General Register. Next, Charity moves that House File 1517 be re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations.
That is correct. I'll make that motion. And what this has to do with, members, is quality measurements that we have, and for what's referred to, we have quality measurements for clinics and hospitals and doctors, and what we have from the federal MACRA legislation that was passed, we have quality measurements that are imposed upon Minnesota providers and hospitals, and what this seeks to do is to align the quality standards that we're going to be measuring ourselves by with the federal standards. We kind of do that for hospitals now, and this would expand this to other providers and clinics. This was brought to me by the MMA, and what this would do, what's called the SQIRMS, which is the way that we measure ourselves within these parameters, that this would create federal alignment for those value measurements. And so that's what I would do. I also have an author's amendment, and that's in your packet, and that is labeled A1.
Chair Dean moves the A1 amendment. Questions to the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted.
Okay. All right. I'm sorry about that. I forgot that. I do have an oral amendment to the amendment, so if we could reconsider that, please. I neglected to do that. Mr. Renner reminded me.
All right. I will move that we reconsider the A1 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails and the A1 amendment is reconsidered. Chair Dean moves the A1 amendment.
Apologies, Mr. Chair and members, for that. On line 1.9, I need to strike using the expedited rulemaking process in section 14.389. So that's line 1.9, strike everything up to the comma after 9. And then strike lines 2.5, 2.6.
All right. And Chair Dean, if you could just go through that one more time for us, and then we'll vote.
Yep. Once again, that's line 1.9, strike everything up to the comma after the numeral 9. And strike lines 2.5 and 2.6, and that would be the oral amendment to be incorporated.
All right, and to that, Ms. Clark.
Mr. Chair and members, let's also strike the second comma on 1.8, so the comma after shall.
Okay, are there any questions to the oral amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the oral amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The oral amendment to the amendment is adopted. Now to the full A1 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The A1 amendment as amended is adopted. Chair Dean, to your bill.
Hi, once again, members. This just seeks to align Minnesota's quality measurement requirements for physicians. Minnesota's current 19 measures for physician practices, only three overlap with the 271 available Medicare measures. Minnesota hospitals measures are already aligned, and this would bring the others into alignment. It puts a limit on the number of measures that the state can require physician practices to report to, six for a single specialty and 10 for multi-specialty clinics. Six is consistent with the number of measures that Medicare will require for most physician practices. I do also have folks from the MMA. Mr. Renner can answer any other questions about how this might relate to what we're currently doing, to what differences that would be, or perhaps other states and how that would work. But once again, we're just trying to align how we measure ourselves for clinics and physicians with what we're doing with hospitals and the federal legislation.
All right. Are there questions for Chair Dean on House Bill 1517? See none. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify on House Bill 1517? Seeing none, final questions? Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And since Mr. Renner didn't testify, I guess I just would like to know if there's been any opposition or questions about this. I mean, you know, this is, I know this seems like really technical stuff, and it is, but it can really matter to people. And I just want some assurance that everybody, all the stakeholders, are okay with it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, no one has contacted me or my office with specific concerns regarding the bill. That doesn't mean that there's unanimity. I just have not heard any group or any person that has contacted me since the bill's introduction.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, that is reassuring. I guess it's sounding like it's kind of a technical thing. I guess I also didn't hear a lot of justification for why we need to do this. Maybe that's what Mr. Renner was, you know, oh, he's shaking his head. You know, it'd be, you know, I guess I don't feel really comfortable because I don't know exactly why we're doing it. It sounds like maybe the reporting has gotten a little burdensome, unnecessarily burdensome. Is that kind of the... You know, but obviously there's always some reason somebody wants something more to be reported, too. So I'm just a bit uncomfortable with that. Maybe Mr. Renner could come up and just kind of tell us what is motivating the bill.
Mr. Renner, welcome to the committee. Can you please state your name for the record and present your testimony?
Mr. Chair and members, Dave Renner, representing the Minnesota Medical Association. To Representative Liebling's questions, that's exactly the reason that this bill is coming forward is Minnesota started our quality measurements back in 2008. At the time, we were one of the few states doing it. Since then, a number of others, including Medicare, has adopted quality measurements. So if we don't do this right now, a physician clinic will have to do one set of measurements for Medicare that don't align with what we're requiring here in Minnesota. So what we're trying to do, as Representative Dean said, we're trying to, first of all, limit some of the burden. We're also trying to say, state, as you continue to do our quality measurements, as you choose those 6 or 10 measures, you must choose from the list that Medicare has already provided, so that we would reduce that burden.
So, Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Renner. Can you give us an example of some things that Minnesota requires to be measured that Medicare would not require?
Mr. Renner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, I don't know of any that Medicare doesn't require, but the example that we've heard quite a bit is we require that we measure how we treat diabetes. Medicare also requires how we treat diabetes. We measure them differently, and the reporting is different. So what we're trying to say is if we're going to measure diabetes, let's measure it the same way so that we reduce that burden. So you don't have to measure it twice and report it differently.
Okay, so Representative Lieber.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Mr. Renner. So that we're not stopping measuring anything that we're already looking at because, you know, we don't want to reduce our standards either, but it's just a matter of aligning the way. So can you assure me that we're not stopping measuring on some quality measure that that we're not hearing about here as we pass this bill out of committee?
Mr. Renner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, I can't give you that assurance in the sense that clearly we're not stopping measuring. We continue to support the measurement of quality and the reporting of quality. What we are saying, however, is because some of these measurements have become significantly burdensome for clinics, we're saying, okay, we're going to have a group of stakeholders come together with the Department of Health, and we're going to choose which ones are most important, and we are going to limit those for a single specialty clinic to 6, and for a multi-specialty clinic to 10. So there may be some things that change, but we're not moving away from the goal of quality measurement and reporting.
Representative Lieber.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So can you tell me, Mr. Renner, right now, when you say multi-specialty clinic, I assume Mayo is one of those, and how many measures do they have now?
Mr. Renner.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to call up Janet Silversmith from our staff who's been working with us, and she can ask the technical.
All right. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Silversmith. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Great. Thank you. Good morning. My name is Janet Silversmith. I'm the Director of Health Policy for the Minnesota Medical Association. And, Mr. Chair and Representative Liebling, your question around how many measures, for example, the Mayo Clinic would be subject to. Under Minnesota's statewide quality reporting and measurement system, there are currently 19 measures that apply to physician practices. For primary care, which may include family medicine, internal medicine, and pediatrics, there are about 9 measures that are included. The others would apply to specialties such as cardiology, endocrinology, orthopedics, neurosurgery. So the Mayo Clinic likely has all 19 of those measures that apply to them and must collect and report those measures to the health department through Minnesota Community Measurement, which is the vendor that the health department uses.
So, Mr. Chair, so thank you for that. So are we then reducing their 19 to 10 with this bill?
Under this, Mr. Chair and Representative, the purpose of the bill would be to reduce the number that Minnesota, through its mandatory measurement, requires to 10. That's not the full extent of all the measurement and data collection and reporting that any physician clinic is subject to. Under the new Medicare quality measure reporting requirements, most medical practices will be asked to submit at least 6. Those 6 may or may not be measures that end up being the 6 that, or 6 or 10 that Minnesota is required to report. Most physician practices are also doing their own internal quality measurement. Many physician practices also participate in data collection and reporting to specialty societies or disease-specific registries. There's also quality measurement reporting for Medicaid and for health plans. The Institute of Medicine in 2015 published a report on the overwhelming burden of measurement and the growth of measurement, with recognition that the additional measures are not really adding value in terms of seeing improvements in health and healthcare delivery, and called for the establishment of 15 core measures across both health and healthcare. So we believe that 10 is a reasonable expectation of what just the state can require, knowing that there's a lot of other measurement and reporting that practices face beyond just what the state collects.
Okay. Representative Liebling.
Mr. Chair, finally, thank you very much. I wonder if, so I see somebody from health there, and I'm wondering, I just want to see if our health economics section is also in agreement with the Department of Health. Somebody want to comment?
Mr. Chair, I think the health department would like to say a few words.
Thank you.
All right. Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Diane Rydrick, and I'm the Director of the Health Policy Division at the Minnesota Department of Health. I just wanted to add to Representative Liebling's question. We've been in conversations with MMA about this bill as it's been evolving, so we have been part of the conversation with them and with some other stakeholders who are also looking to make changes to SQIRMs, maybe in slightly different directions. And we are comfortable with the spirit of moving towards alignment. We recognize that lack of alignment between federal and state reporting requirements is a burden for providers, so we are definitely in line with the spirit of that. There are a lot of parts of this bill that we have come to agreement on. There are some that we're still discussing and hoping to continue to have those conversations as it evolves and moves through the process.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Any other questions for this? Representative Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess in part of those measurements, I guess I'm kind of curious, as I sort of, from the department, I think this may be towards you, Ms. Silversmith, but pain is something that we've talked a lot about with this ongoing question about pain medications and opioids, and the way we measure that is different for everybody. And may I ask the question about is pain one of these things that are still in question, whether we should make it part of the measurement of quality of care or not? Because, again, some of us are very concerned that it's easy to get rid of pain with the right pills. And if that should really be asked at the end of the quality care for a patient, if that's one of the measurements that you actually are discussing at this point, I'm curious as to the outlook on your pain measurements. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. All right, Ms.
Yep, Mr. Chair and Representative Baker. So right now the system does not have any quality measures that explicitly look at that issue of pain management, which is obviously connected to a much broader set of questions around opioid use and dependence and prescribing and pain management more broadly. I think your question in some ways gets to Ms. Silversmith's point that there are a lot of different ways that we can measure information about healthcare outcomes or patient experience. Sometimes this system is the best way to do it. Some things lend themselves to being measured in that way. Some things lend themselves to being measured in other ways. So a measure that is specifically about pain management and, you know, a relationship to opioids has not been one that has really bubbled up to the top of the conversation. I think one thing that this bill would do is allow a more thoughtful conversation and sort of a more open conversation about what is important to measure in Minnesota and a thoughtful process of deciding whether this is the right way to do it or there are other ways to do it. I do think it also gets at one of the areas we're still in discussion about, which is what do we do if the federal system maybe doesn't get at something in the right way that works for Minnesota to address a gap that we have.
Thank you. Representative Baker, any other questions for Chair Dean or the testifiers on House File 1517? Seeing none, final word, Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to Representative Baker, I did check with Mr. Renner that the pain is not part of the 271, nor would it be. But you bring up an excellent point about patient satisfaction surveys and patient satisfaction with how we rate hospitals and physicians and clinics and, in fact, how we pay them in some cases, which is a very important measurement. And I want to make sure that we continue to work on that and make sure that we are not incentivizing prescribers, hospitals, or anybody else focus emphasis on pain, on being pain-free as part of a premier part of patient satisfaction, because that's the wrong thing to do. So we want to make sure that we keep a close eye on that. I appreciate the question, Representative Baker.
All right. And with the change in the amendments, we can also change where the bill goes now. It doesn't have to go to government ops. And so Chair Dean would like to amend his initial motion that House File 1517 be referred from government ops to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. So with that, Chair Dean.
Mr. Chairman, might I speak?
Sure. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. My apologies for being late. Traffic was unbelievable this morning. My name is Phil Griffin, and I represent Minnesota Community Measurement. My client and I had a chance to meet with Chairman Dean. We spoke about this bill. about 2 weeks ago. And we appreciate the efforts that are being made and the concerns that the MMA is bringing forward and trying to make sure that we have a semblance of ease for the providers in terms of the reporting that they have to do, but also trying to meet the goals that we have of trying to improve measurement. Mr. Chairman, the concerns that we would bring forward just are very brief, and we hope to work with the authors as we move forward on this one. But we want to make sure that as we move forward to eliminate measures, we don't just eliminate measures for the sake of eliminating measures, but we eliminate the correct ones as we try and develop new ones. We currently work with seven measures. We've made a recommendation to eliminate one of the measures because it's kind of low-hanging fruit and is being adopted by most of the providers. That's the kind of thing that we want to have happen. This was an asthma measure, and the compliance by all providers has been just amazing. On the other hand, we are a little bit concerned that we might end up in a position where Medicare is making the decisions for Minnesota, and we are way ahead of what Medicare is doing here in Minnesota. So we're very appreciative of the language in the amendment that brings in community input and tries to help bring that along. We're a little bit concerned about some of the other language, and we'll try and work with the chairman as we move forward with this. Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Chair.
Wow, you're spending members. $1,000 today, Mr. Griffin. Questions for the testifier?
I look forward to working with Mr. Griffin. Of course, anybody else on the committee between now and finance, happy to do so.
All right. And with that, Chair Dean will renew his motion that House File 1517, as amended, is referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye. 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 Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails, and House File 1517, as amended, is referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. Thank you, Chair Dean.
Thank you, members.
And as Representative Zerwas is making his way down, Representative Franzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So in honor of my 40th birthday today, I have brought some treats to pass along the table. So. I know, 40.
Congratulations on making it to 40, Representative France.
There was a time I was wondering myself, so.
We understand. Representative Zerwas, welcome to the committee. I will move that House File 1405 be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. We have the bill in front of us. Representative Zerwas, are you ready? To your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 1405 is a continuation of the legislature's efforts to try to provide adequate reimbursement for medical supplies and services for Minnesotans so that they can receive the quality care at home, which naturally increases their quality of life dramatically. At the same time, helps reduce the cost associated with their treatment. Today, we focus specifically on ventilators and the reimbursement costs around ventilators, particularly complex and critical, a critically important device in the delivery of care to critically ill Minnesotans that we can provide in their homes. With me today are Cameo Zender and General Counsel and COO of Pediatric Home Services, and Judy Keel, Chief Clinical Officer at Pediatric Home Services, to help explain this bill and the ongoing discussions with DHS. And I want to give a lot of credit to the department. We've had several, over a year of work with the department and different reimbursement codes. How this all kind of gets mucked up with the ventilators specifically is they went from multiple options for billing codes within MA for ventilators down to just two codes. And so when they, and that suddenly at the federal level doesn't align to what the reimbursement schedule is at the state level. And so the reimbursements are so low that it really is a challenge to meet the need of patients and deliver this critical equipment to keep people in their homes and to keep people out of the intensive care unit. and so we have to make sure that we cover our costs while we do this, which in the long run still continues to be a significant cost savings to MA and to the state of Minnesota. With that, Mr. Chair, I'll turn it over to my testifiers.
All right, welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Yes. Good morning. My name is Cameo Zender. I am General Counsel and Chief Operating Officer with Pediatric Home Service, and I also serve as the chair on the Legislative Committee for the Midwest Association of Medical Equipment Suppliers. Thank you for hearing us this morning. As Representative Zerwas describes, we're seeking your support on a very narrow piece of legislation related to ventilators. This bill will maintain reimbursement for ventilators in a way that was intended by the legislature in an amount that was appropriated by state funds and in the amount that was heavily relied upon by providers. In the alternative, if this bill is not passed, providers of this very technical service face a devastating and retroactive clawback of payments already made for services rendered back to January 2016. That clawback, in effect, would take back one-third of the payments already made for these services. The legislature has long supported the value of durable medical equipment and medical supplies as an integral piece of our healthcare system. The legislature has further recognized that the needs of our medical assistance population, which encompass vulnerable populations, including medically complex infants and adults with disabilities, is simply different than the needs of seniors served by Medicare. This piece of legislation is similar to others passed in years past, in that it creates a payment methodology for ventilators that is distinct from Medicare and recognizes those differences under the medical assistance payment system. So how did we get here? As Representative Zerwas describes, this really stemmed from decisions made at a federal level. In January of 2016, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services made a major overhaul to ventilators in the way vents are defined, in the way they're billed, and in the way they're reimbursed. As described, the billing code set went from 5 codes, which very adequately describe the differences in the types of ventilators and the methods to administer ventilation to patients, and that resulted in 2 generic codes. By consolidating these codes, we really lost the ability to define ventilators differently and to reimburse ventilators differently. In consolidating the codes, CMS adopted the reimbursement rate that was the lowest and the oldest and applied that reimbursement rate to those 2 new codes. We think it's really important to note that the rate that was adopted was actually established in 1986, decades before the technology that we currently use to provide ventilation today were even introduced on the market. In anticipation of this drastic change, the Midwest Association of Medical Equipment Suppliers worked collaboratively with the department so that we could crosswalk those billing codes and use modifiers to really recreate those definitions and the rates that were in existence previous to the CMS overhaul. This collaboration took place over several months, during which time providers of ventilators continued to support their patients without payment under the medical assistance system. In April of 2016, we believe the task at hand had been accomplished when DHS notified providers that the rates that had been in existence before the CMS overhaul were reestablished, that the claim system was prepared, and that payments would be forthcoming. Many of you may recall that during the same time period, we worked with the department and with the legislature on another piece of legislation. This was a broader piece of legislation that created what we'll call a technical fix to the overall payment methodologies for durable medical equipment and supplies. That technical fix had the same goal, to continue to differentiate medical assistance payment structures from Medicare payment structures, again, because of the great differences in those patient populations. With your support, that legislation passed last session. Unfortunately, though, a short time after, we came to realize that there was a significant unintended consequence from that piece of legislation specifically related to ventilators. Although the goal was to differentiate the payment methodologies from Medicare to Medicaid, we came to understand that that newer piece of legislation actually had the opposite effect for ventilators, and that it instructed the department to use Medicare rates for ventilators. To say that the providers were surprised, I would say, would be a complete understatement. We really tried to work hard together to come up with what we believe to be a common solution. Having recognized this different consequence, again, we worked closely with the department and have continued to do so so that we could fix this issue specific to ventilators, and the result of that is the legislation in front of you today. Also, we think it's only fair to let you know that we're continuing to work with the department to come up with final language on this bill. We want nothing more than to have other unintended consequences. So to that end, we continue to work with the department and anticipate that the language may revise through future committees.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Zender, for your testimony this morning. Ms. Giel?
Yes.
Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Yes, thank you. My name is Judy Giel, and I'm Chief Clinical Officer for Pediatric Home Service. I've been in the ventilator business for close to 40 years. My background is respiratory therapy. This technical fix is critical to the ongoing success of medical equipment providers serving individuals with tracheostomies requiring mechanical ventilation in their homes. There is a very large investment in not only the technology. In my 40 years of experience working with ventilators, there have been at least 10 iterations of different types of methods and equipment used to ventilate patients. So we continuously invest, take money that we receive and invest in this new technology, as well as providing a minimum of 25 hours of training to patients while they're still hospitalized before they go home. We have 24-hour support available at all times and must respond to these individuals within a two-hour period. So we use this money constantly to reinvest in the programs to deliver this very safe patient care services and equipment for vulnerable people who require this to sustain their life. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Giel, for your testimony this morning. Are there any questions for these testifiers? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not so much a question, but just thank you for the explanation. So this is so complicated sometimes, and you laid it out, I think, very well. And looking at the language of the bill, I guess I do have just a question. It's not so much to the language of the bill itself, which I fully support your effort here to get this fixed. As I'm understanding all of this, you know, what you do is really different than what Medicare does. And so that linkage can be really problematic. I think that's kind of the bottom line for this, right? But also, I know that the kind of service that you provide is, you don't just provide equipment, you provide people to operate equipment, right? And that's what you were talking about. And I'm just wondering, is that a completely separate rate from the actual equipment rate that we're talking about in this bill? Is it, I assume that that's complete different billing code? Because I know that some of the vendors of medical equipment, of durable medical equipment, it kind of goes along with their service, and this is separated, right? Can you just give me a little clarity around that?
Sure. All right. Ms. Zender.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, thank you for the question. Pediatric Home Service is a comprehensive home care provider, so we provide services that fall under durable medical equipment, that fall under home care nursing, that fall under home infusion. But to keep this specific to the scope of durable medical equipment, there is a clinical component that is included for the reimbursement of this product, and that is the clinical expertise and support of licensed respiratory therapists that are specifically trained in pediatric care that provide the support and assessment, support of the equipment and assessment of the patient's ongoing respiratory needs.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you. So, I think that's really important to understand here, too, that it isn't just whether this same equipment would be built this way or this way, because it's a package, right? And it's, in this context, it's a really critically important package, that it be the right package with the people and the equipment, because we're talking here about very, very fragile children who are being maintained in their homes. And you can't do that without real specialization. So, thank you.
All right. Any other questions for these testifiers? Seeing none, is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify on House File 1405? Seeing none, final questions from members for the bill author? Seeing none, final word, Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members. As I mentioned earlier, we are continuing to work with the department and hope that we'll find a solution moving forward so that as Ms. Ender mentioned, that clawback would be very significant and harmful to these providers. So that's something we've been working very closely with the department to try to avoid.
All right. With that, Representative Zerwas, I will renew my motion that House File 1405 be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails, and House File 1405 is referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. Thank you, Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, guys. Have a great day.
All right. Representative Pearson, are you ready, or do you need a minute? Okay. Representative Pearson, please make your way down. The first bill up is House File 774. Representative Pearson, I will move that House File 774 be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. Representative Pearson, the bill is in front of us whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members of the Health and Human Services. Roads weren't so good coming up from Rochester this morning, so I'm sorry, and I appreciate your indulgence in switching the order up for us. House File 774 is a bill that is working with the deaf and blind and hard of hearing. We're basically clarifying language. First, actually, I have an A1 amendment that I should probably address.
All right, I will move the A1 amendment. Representative Pearson, to your amendment.
If there's any questions on the amendment, it really is just clarifying a couple things that we've worked with the department on, and just a couple of technical changes.
Okay, are there any questions to the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A1 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The A1 amendment is adopted. Representative Pearson, to your bill in the form you wish to present it.
So, the main focus of this bill is basically clarifying some language, continuing to provide supports for our communities that need additional resources for deaf, blind, hard hearing. And actually, I have a witness here today named Jamie Taylor, and she would like to share some information of some of the services that she receives. And through her interpreter, will give us some information.
All right, welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Hi, my name is Jamie Taylor, member of the Commission of Deaf, Blind, and Hard of Hearing Minnesotans. My name is Jamie Taylor, and I am deaf-blind. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for hearing this bill today. And thank you, Representative Pearson, for authoring it. 40 years ago, a group of visionary deaf, deaf-blind, and hard-of-hearing Minnesotans advocated for legislation that would overcome communication barriers. The legislature agreed, and the Deaf and Hard-of-Hearing Services Division was created, with regional offices and citizen advisory committees throughout the state. They provide direct consumer assistance in American Sign Language and English. assistive technology demonstrations, training, and consultation, mental health services, and grants that increase access. I wouldn't be here today if it weren't for the critical services they provide. Deafblindness results in isolation and disconnection from the world without supports. Helen Keller made great contributions because she obtained visual and auditory information through Annie Sullivan, what we deafblind people call support service providers today, or SSPs. The division provides these services to truly break down barriers. Naturally, many changes have occurred over the past 40 years. Our board heard from regional members and advocates that services needed to be modernized. The bill keeps the regional offices and adds virtual and actual satellite offices so that people can receive services closer to home. Ideally, these offices would be co-located with public entities or nonprofits who serve our community. We want the division to educate and train other state, regional, and local service providers about how to work with deaf, deafblind, and hard of hearing people to prevent problems before they occur. This bill provides a plan for modernizing the services and gives funding to ensure that critical needs are met and that waiting lists do not happen again. It invests in technology and staff training needs to provide services using a 21st century model. Please support House File 774. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Taylor, for your testimony this morning. Questions for Ms. Taylor, Representative Lohmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Pearson, for this bill and for Ms. Taylor for your great testimony. I'm just really fascinated by what's happening right behind you. Can you talk a little bit about the gentleman and what he's helping you with?
Oh.
Ms. Taylor.
Yes, thank you very much. Right now, I know that some of you are smiling. I would never have known that before in my life, and it has truly changed my life, truly. He's using what's called ProTactile, and it is a system and a language that conveys visual information and in a tactual way. So when my hands are reading the Braille display or signing, I can get that critical, instantaneous information. So I can be as equal as you can be. Imagine just talking into a void, a blank void. That was what it was like before. And if you don't know, if your audience is crying or laughing, oh my goodness, you don't want to be, you know, it can totally change your presentation. So thank you. And this ProTactile would be in the bill. It truly changes lives. And I have to say, I wish I had this growing up. Knew it because it's so new. Because being graded by a teacher on your presentation skills and you don't know what the audience is reacting, it's not very fun or fair.
Follow-up, Representative Lohmer.
No, thank you very much for that explanation. That's just an awesome process. Glad to know more about it. Thank you.
Any other questions for Ms. Taylor? Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Taylor. I had a question just about the bill. If you could just share a little bit about why the movement from 8 to 6 regional centers, and then just share a little bit about how those are decided upon based on geography and around just population centers that may have more folks needing services. If you could just share a little bit about that, that'd be helpful. Thank you.
All right, and it looks like Ms. Frazier is going to be helping us out with that one. Welcome back to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record on this bill and present your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Beth Frazier with the Commission of Deaf, Blind, and Hard of Hearing Minnesotans. And the current law actually provides a maximum number of regional offices. It says they may have up to 8 regional offices. And as the Commission members discussed it, they feel like having offices in Greater Minnesota is very important. And so instead of having a ceiling, they wanted to have a floor and to ensure that there would be at least 6 regional offices. There are people here from the division who could talk more about where they choose to have the offices. I brought and forgot to hand out a map of the state and where the offices are currently in the region. So I don't know if there's a page. I'd be happy to hand that out. That was a great segue. Thank you for reminding me about my handout. So I'm sure the division could talk more about how they choose where to have them, but that is the intent of that piece.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That exactly answers my question. Thank you.
All right. Any other questions for the testifiers at the table? Seeing none, is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify on House File 774? If you could please make your way down. Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
My name is Michelle Paulson, and I'm a parent that has used Deaf Mentor services. I'm a proud mother of 3 children. 2 of them are deaf, hard of hearing, and I'd like to share my story on how this program has changed my family's life. My daughter specifically, we had the most trouble with her. As a parent, we were struggling to get appropriate services for my children's school district. And it was such a relief to be given a deaf mentor. My deaf mentor didn't just teach American Sign Language. They shared different technologies to assist with communication, discussed different school programs that specialized in deaf education, offered various social events to mingle with other deaf families, created a support network, and also taught us about deaf culture. Deaf children do not learn the same as hearing children, and convincing the schools in our area for the need of ASL family services felt impossible. My deaf mentor is who informed my family of early childhood services from the Minnesota State Academy for the Deaf. My family found that resource so helpful to both our deaf children. We actually drove my daughter down from Hermantown twice a week for a year to get these services on top of the deaf mentor services that came into our home. And we actually, the next year, moved to Faribault so they could attend MSAD full-time and their summer program. If it wasn't for a deaf mentor working with our family on ASL and letting us know about other options that are out there, my daughter would still be biting me, scratching me, and hiding under tables. Sorry. She was isolated and acting out in frustration because she couldn't communicate. And because of the knowledge I received from my deaf mentor, my daughter is now signing and communicating and socializing. If she has friends and she participates in school. I'm sorry. And when you don't come from a family that is deaf, navigating parenting of a child who struggles with language deprivation is overwhelming, and why deaf mentors are so important. I just want you to imagine if you had to learn a second language
just to communicate with your child. You know, to let them know that you love them. And basic functions like bedtime and bath time. And just, these deaf mentors are so invaluable. And not everyone can have the opportunity to move across the state for more services. Like I said, I was from Hermantown, and it's a great city, but in northeast Minnesota, there is not enough deaf and hard of hearing services. And I ask that you support this bill and help with language deprivation. This changes people's lives, and I thank you so much for your time and consideration in this matter. It has truly changed my family, and I just can't say enough good things about it, and I thank you again for...
Thank you, Ms. Kelsen, for your testimony this morning and your willingness to share your story with us and your personal and uplifting testimony that you're able to give us this morning. Are there any questions for the testifier? Representative Liebling.
Thank you very much. Not really a question, but just, you know, thank you so much for being here to talk about your experience. As you know, if we haven't lived it, we might not have any idea of what that's like. So it's really important that you're here today, and the emotion is part of it. Don't apologize for that. I have just a question maybe for Ms. Fraser. And it's just a pretty simple question. Is any of this funding matched by Medicaid funds? Or is it just strictly state funding?
Ms. Fraser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Liebling. My understanding is that some of the funding is matched by federal funding. I know almost nothing about the whole DHS budget, but I know that when we got the one-time funding passed in 2015 that this would continue and add to, that when the spreadsheet came out, I was confused because the state number was less and then it said something about federal money. So there are people here from the department who could answer that much better than I.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you. And that's okay because it's going to finance. We don't need that now. But I just wanted to comment that when I hear stories like the last testifier or Ms. Taylor, it just makes me really proud of Minnesota. You know, we are a state where these kinds of things can happen. Because I think our constituents want to invest in making sure that people are productive and have full lives and can participate. And that's, I think, something that is a real Minnesota value that we all share. So thank you. Thank you for being here.
Are there any other questions for the bill author or the testifiers? Seeing none, Representative Pearson, final word.
I don't think I can say it better than what's been said. That's why I kept my comments pretty brief in the beginning. I knew our testifiers would be able to convey this message much better. I would point out that this is a fulfillment of a promise that's long overdue in the state of Minnesota. Americans with Disabilities Act is something that was put upon us, and with the advancements in technology, with the tools that are available today that weren't available 36 years ago, we're now bringing our communities to another level, another playing field. Watching Ms. Taylor give her testimony was amazing. You were watching what was going on behind her. I was watching what was going on in front of her, which is the Braille reader that she's using in front of her is just remarkable to watch, and her delivering her prepared remarks was really something to be seen, and again, I'm hoping this bill will help that occur for more and more Minnesotans.
All right, and with that, I will renew my motion that House File 774, as amended, be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails, and House File 774, as amended, is referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. Ms. Taylor, Ms. Kelson, thank you very much for coming in today and presenting on this bill. All right, next up is Representative Pearson's House File 1490. And as the testifying table gets shifted, I will move that House File 1490 be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. We have the bill in front of us, Representative Pearson. When you are ready, to your bill.
Good news is Dr. Peterson usually makes me smile instead of cry, so we're going to shift gears here a little bit. Do you want to actually pull the bill out and read it? Although, again, some of the needs of our communities in dental care would make you cry. If you've seen some of the pictures, and Representative Liebling often is probably still hanging in her office, and I know we can't have a dialogue in this forum, but it is really something that you see what pain some kids are going through, and that's also emotional. I just know that Dr. Peterson's positive outlook on things always makes us smile and appreciate this. So this bill is basically got a couple phases to it, and I can't remember if we have an A1 on this one. I believe we do.
Yes, and I will move the A1 amendment, Representative Pearson, to that amendment.
Some definitions and it just substituting some specific words.
All right, are there any questions for the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A1 amendment, please signify by saying aye. Aye, opposed, same sign. The amendment is adopted. Representative Pearson, to the bill in the form you wish to present it.
So again, we're looking to provide some additional dental services to targeted schools in high-risk areas, in areas or neighborhoods where the access to quality dental services is maybe reduced, and so this would provide some dental sealants to children between the ages of 6 and 9, and we also are starting a pilot program in the second section of this, and to give testimony today, like I mentioned, I do have Dr. Peterson with me, and again, the testifiers tend to have a more compelling case than the technical description of a bill anyhow, so if you would, I'd have Dr. Peterson take over.
All right, Dr. Peterson, welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Thank you so much, Representative Pearson. Mr. Chair and member, thank you very kindly for hearing this bill. My name is Martin Peterson. I'm CEO of Community Dental Care. I would like to refer to the handout number one, page one. I would like to spend a little bit of time talking about this, as it is a precursor of HL 1490. This is actually on page one, is the report to legislators on HF 778 that passed in 2015. It's about early dental prevention initiative. In August 2015 to present, 23 organizations supporting this initiative met 7 times to give the advice and direction with the guidance of the MDH and Community Dental Care, which is a steering committee. From August 15 to present, steering committee has met 8 times to discuss the direction of implementing HF 778. In May 2016, Community Dental Care started a pilot project for children aged 0 to 2, named it Minnesota Cavity Free Kids. June to December 16, advisory group and 5 work groups met on periodic basis to conceptualize educational material and distribution plan. Multiple focus group discussions were conducted and incentive was finalized. Community outreach events were organized and oral hygiene material for infants and toddlers were distributed to communities of color and recent immigrants. January 2017, MDH High Early Dental Disease Prevention Initiative Coordinator. January 2017 in the H-name, the ETPI campaign, Healthy Teeth, Healthy Baby, based on focus group findings. March 2017, MVH designed and drafted oral health key messages for infants and toddlers in Somalia, among Spanish English languages for radio distribution to target communities. Public service announcement PSA will be broadcasted through non-commercial KFAI and KALY radio station from March to June 2017. These radio stations serve more than 100,000 diverse groups such as Somalian and other Eastern African community on a daily basis. July 2017 to 2019, we are hoping to implement HF 1490 if passed, with 5 community dental clinics, including at least 2 clinics in Greater Minnesota and 3 in metro area. The data and experience from these clinics can help us develop a more complete preventive dental care and education plan for parents and babies. As you can see, the advisory group consists of actually not 23 but 24 organizations. I would like to move on to page 2, which is the HF 1940. We would like to ask first the legislators to support prevention of caries in permanent teeth via school-based silly program for children ages 6 to 9 years old. Studies have shown that without sealant, 40% of back teeth develop decay over the 2-year process. With the sealant, this reduced to 6%, and Fatima Ali will testify more about this. And secondly, we would like to ask legislator for your support in the prevention of caries in primary or baby teeth, starting with pilot projects for underserved children. This is necessary because early childhood caries affect the general population. However, it is 32 times more likely to occur in infants who are of low socioeconomic status, who consume a diet high in sugar, and whose mothers have a low education level. To help solve this problem and in response to HF 778 that was passed in 2015, we started a program in May 2016 called it 0 to 2 Minnesota Cavity-Free Kids Program. This pilot program has seen 68 children. Currently, we taught the parents in these group settings to care for their children's teeth. We provide lab-to-lab examination, prophy, apply fluoride varnish. From these, we have learned many interesting lessons that has helped us successfully implement our program, such as the parent need to be taught more than once, sometimes twice, sometimes 3 times before they get it. And often, both parents must be educated. A mother in the program informs us that she brushes her child's teeth rigorously, but the child still develops cavities. Upon investigation, we learn that the father continues to give the child candies and pop at will. They had never been present at any of the appointments, so we have to fetch him and teach him as well. We started our first cohort with 4 families, and now we have grown to have 16 families scheduled for our 11th cohort. If nurtured properly, this program can really escalate rapidly through the words of mouth of the underserved parents and interpreters. The expansion of this kind of pilot program to many communities is necessary, so we can obtain more data to help us to implement this kind of work throughout the state of Minnesota. Now I would like to invite Fatima Ali and Pania He to testify on sealant and early initiative prevention.
All right, welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you. My name is Fatima Ali, and I work as a dental assistant for Community Dental Care's sealant, school-based sealant program. This program is very valuable. Not only do we provide dental prevention for the underserved children at schools, but we also provide oral health education for these children. I recall a child who was hesitant to participate in the classroom, and he was sent to the office, and the child was not speaking. Later on,
we found that this child actually had pain, but he didn't know how to express the pain. So later on when we did the screening, there were serious cavities in his mouth where we were able to refer him to a treatment. So this program really helps children in those cases and even before the cavities get serious. We also place sealants for these children at their schools. So providing sealants at school will help prevent these kind of scenarios from happening, such as child being in pain, being sent to the office, and not knowing how to express. We started this program back in 2011, and we started with 5 schools, but today we're serving 21 schools, and that shows the demand and the need for this kind of program at the schools. Our clinic and several clinics would like to escalate these kind of services, so we really thank you for supporting this bill. School-based sealants program proven strategies to decrease oral health disparities in our communities. Not only are we improving the oral health of these children, we're also improving their systemic health. This bill will provide funding to help several community clinics that already provide sealants in the schools to increase access for vulnerable students. With your support and funding, we can continue preventive efforts and oral health education to those in need. Thank you and for supporting the bill.
All right, thank you. Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and community members, my name is Tania Herr, and I am the program coordinator for the Minnesota Cavity Free Kids program since November of last year. In my short time as a coordinator, I have had the opportunity to speak with and educate many parents, and I have witnessed the positive impact of this program. As a coordinator, one of my responsibilities is to go out into the community and educate parents about oral health and how to prevent childhood caries. In fact, 2 weeks ago, I was at a homeless shelter for teenage mothers whose children were all under 1 year old, when one of the mothers asked a very crucial question. She wanted to know, how come she didn't receive this information at the hospital when she gave birth to her baby? This, Mr. Chairman and community members, shows that there is a lack of oral health knowledge in our community amongst new mothers and the necessity of it. It is a common misconception that oral health education only entails telling parents to brush their child's teeth. However, simply telling mothers to brush their child's teeth is not enough to combat early childhood caries. We recognize that caries is a multifactorial disease, therefore it requires a holistic approach in prevention and treatment, and our program is doing exactly that. During one of our recall events in which we re-evaluated patients who have been in our program for 6 months, I was working with a mother who successfully brushes her daughter's teeth 2 times a day, and she limits her child's sugar intake. However, we found that her daughter had decalcification, or the start of cavities. This mother was appalled and troubled, and asked if our program was giving her the proper information. However, after conducting a caries risk assessment with her, I found that the mother puts her daughter to bed with a bottle, even after brushing her teeth. Had we not have educated this parent, she would have never known that her daughter is suffering from baby bottle tooth decay, one of the most severe manifestations of the syndrome. These are just two of the many stories that I have encountered in my short time as a program coordinator. I see it imperative for the continuation and expansion of this program and the necessity to disseminate oral health information in our community at an infectious rate. Although our target populations include low-income, minority, and refugee children, we are finding that the burden of oral health disparity affects all Minnesotans. Our goal is to ensure that all Minnesotan children grow up cavity-free, and they all need your help. With your support and additional funding, we can continue to tackle oral health disparities in our youngest community members. So thank you for allowing me to represent them today.
Thank you, Ms. Herr, for your testimony. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House File 1490? Seeing none, questions from the committee. Representative Cagle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the work you guys do. I work at an organization that does early Head Start and Head Start programming, so this is always a big part of our programming. And I was just looking at the languages that you guys do outreach in and was wondering if you've started to develop any materials in Karen.
Mr.
Yes, sorry.
We do have goal sheets in Karen, not necessarily program flyers, but we do have interpreters. We work closely with the Karen interpreters, so when we go out, we have interpreters there as well. And then when they come in for appointments at our clinics, we have their interpreters there as well. So we do communicate very well with the Karen population.
Representative Hagel. Any other questions from committee members? Representative Liebling.
Thank you very much. And could we just, one of you, Ms. Ali or Ms. Herr, just tell us kind of how this works in the schools? Like, I gather it's a pretty simple process to put the sealant on, but how is it working? Do you have to have the equipment there, or do you just need an office where the children come in? Just give us a little snapshot of what that looks like.
Ms. Ali.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, before we get to the schools, we make sure we have the proper consent forms filled out by the parents. And again, that is translated in many different languages. So if the parent speaks Somali or Korean, we have all of them ready. And then we have a contact person at the school who we communicate with, and he or she gives us an area, open bay area that we could bring our equipments to. So we do hold all our equipments there, portable dental chairs and everything we need. So they do give us a space. So, and that's how we do it. And, of course, we do practice our infection control and do our services because we do sealant and screening. We don't do any x-rays there. We don't do any treatment other than sealant there. So if the child does have a cavity, we refer them to their dental home, or they're welcome to come to our clinic to get the work done. But, yes, we do bring everything with us.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you very much. That's really helpful. And, of course, as Representative Pearson said, I think this is so important. You know, this is really low-cost stuff that really makes a difference to people's lives and health. And so, you know, I think in an era when we're going to have less money, not more, we're going to have a lot less, this is the kind of place we need to be investing to try to make sure that we do the most with what we have. So thank you.
All right. Are there any other questions or comments for the testifiers or for the bill author? Seeing none, I will renew my motion then that House File 1490 be, as amended, be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails and House File 1490 as amended is referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. Finally, today, members, we will take up House File 1619. I will present that bill from the chair here. So I would like to move that House File 1619 be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. House File 1619 is the dish bill that many of us have been hearing about that deals with children's hospitals throughout the state. As a little bit of background, both Gillette and Children's receive federal disproportionate share hospital payments, which is where we get the acronym that sounds like DISH, because of their high volume of MA patients. These payments help offset losses for serving high Medicaid populations. CMS has implemented a new interpretation of federal law that requires states to include commercial insurance payments for Medicaid-eligible patients in the uncompensated care calculation. This is an interpretation which was discovered first on CMS's website as FAQ number 33. It is not a law change or a rule change at the federal level. If that interpretation is upheld, these two hospitals face losing more than $25 million a year together. The bill we have in front of us after we adopt the DE protects payments that the hospitals currently receive under our state MA programs if the interpretation is upheld. This isn't new money going to the hospitals. It's simply maintaining the state portion if the interpretation stays. With that, I would like to move the DE-1 amendment. Are there any questions for the DE-1 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the DE-1 signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The amendment is adopted. Any questions to the overall bill? Seeing none, I will renew my motion that House File 1619 as amended be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails and House File 1619 as amended is re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. With that, members, we are adjourned until tomorrow morning. Thank you.